This Biz News briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees.
Welcome to this Biz News briefing. It's Thursday, the 16th of January, and we have a full show for you today. In our top story, the former Minister of Education, Sports, Art and Culture in Zimbabwe's MDC, David Coulthard, has a stern warning for the Democratic Alliance in the context of the Government of National Unity in South Africa, given his experience in the Government of National Unity in Zimbabwe, which the MDC entered in 2009. Chris Steyn caught up with Coulthard earlier today.
But I think there are some lessons to be learnt by the DA. And the one critical thing is that despite that subverted playing ground, the MDC actually contributed to their own downfall through some of their actions. So, for example, MDC ministers quickly assimilated themselves into the ZANU-PF method of operation. There were all the temptations of Mercedes-Benz's. Morgan Tsvangirai, as prime minister, took a new luxurious house. And so in the mind of the electorate, in the eyes of the electorate, by the end of those 5 years, most NDC ministers couldn't easily be distinguished from your average ZANU-PF minister. It looked to many of the electorate that we had just been bought, and that, quite frankly, there was no incentive to vote for the MDC compared to ZANU-PF, because amongst many in the electorate, the feeling was that quite frankly, we were no different. We were in there for the goodies that we could get out of the office, not to try and bring about real change. So that was number one. We assimilated ourselves. Secondly, I think that we were naive. If I take myself, for example, I threw myself into education, which was the right thing to do, but I did so to the exclusion, for example, of taking more of an interest in the constitutional reform process that was going on. And whilst undoubtedly I and other MDC ministers were successful in our particular ministries, we did so at quite a cost, and that is that we spent so much time, for example, in education, that little time was spent on trying to tackle issues like the uneven playing field in the electoral environment, trying to, let's speak about the Fourth Estate, speaking out more vigorously regarding the lack of independence of the media, speaking out regarding the lack of independence of the judiciary. And so by the time the 2013 elections came, where we were running our own ministry successfully, we had naively allowed ZANU-PF, as I say, in a very cynical fashion, to consolidate their power. And so applying that to South Africa, the DA, the IFP, they need to demonstrate some savvy. It's a balance. Obviously, they've got to deliver effectively on their own ministries so that they can demonstrate to the electorate in South Africa that they are competent and inspire confidence. And that needs to be their dominant responsibility. But they must not ever do that at the cost of allowing the ANC to consolidate their power in the areas of civic bodies, universities, the judiciary, and critically, the media.
What are the strongest parallels that you are seeing currently between what happened in Zimbabwe's GNU under Robert Mugabe and what is happening in the first months of the GNU in South Africa?
Well, I've been quite impressed by what I've seen. The parallels are that I've seen DA ministers, for example, if you look at Home Affairs, it appears as if a lot of the backlog in applications has been dealt with. That's very impressive. I read a story, I think last week, where it was clarified that DA ministers were not taking new vehicles, that they simply took over old vehicles. And all of that is to be commended. But there's quite a long way to go. Yet it is important that they maintain that standard. You know, the public are tired, I think, of the huge cavalcades, the huge entourages, the luxurious standard. This is certainly the case in Zimbabwe, and I suspect it's the case in South Africa, where ministers get into these positions and suddenly their lifestyle transforms dramatically. It's critical that the DA guards against that so that they retain the goodwill of the electorate. And it's a real opportunity for them to give a different example to the electorate. But I think that what has to be conveyed to the electorate is that DA and IFP ministers understand the notion of servant leadership, that they are there to serve, not to be served. And that needs to be a constant theme throughout their time in office.
Moving to the airline industry in South Africa, SAF Air has stood up a hornet's nest by saying that it is an industry norm to overbook flights. Both Airlink and SEM Air have come out strongly saying they do not overbook flights as it is directly in contravention of the South African Consumer Protection Act. Alec Hogg spoke to Miles van den Molen, who is the founder and CEO of SEM Air, to get the lowdown.
But now we've got a debate in South Africa after SAF Air had some very angry customers that could not get onto a flight that they'd booked for. And it says, its statement was that everybody does it in South Africa. Now, you, SEM Air, do you?
So, hey, nice to be on the show again. Thank you. It is done in some regions. My reading of the Consumer Protection Act is that it's illegal in South Africa. And we certainly don't do overbooking on flights. And I know Airlink's come out with a statement that's similar to ours, to say that they don't overbook flights at all. And that's our understanding, that it's not actually allowed. So for SAF Air to go out on a limb and claim that is very improper.
Explain why airlines overbook in the first place.
So there's a likelihood that some people won't show for the flight. So they say, 3% of passengers won't arrive. So therefore, we oversell by 3%. The aircraft will depart full. And effectively, it becomes additional revenue. There are airlines, for example, like Lyft, that allows a lot of flexibility right up to the point of departure. So there'd probably be a slightly higher rate of churn there, because people are able to move their flights more easily. But my understanding, SAF Air's model is that it's 100% no-show, so effectively they are selling the seat twice, is it? In my estimation.
How do you mean 100% no-show?
If you're going to arrive for your flight, there's no refund available. So their stated position was, because some people don't arrive for their flights, that's lost revenue. That's not my understanding of their business model. They retain that revenue and then oversell the flight in addition to that.
So why would they make a statement of the type that you've mentioned to say that, well, everybody does it, even though you mentioned earlier that in South Africa, this is illegal?
They admitted to overbooking. Why they would make a statement on everybody else's behalf is a bit of a mystery. But it's very inappropriate. So it's a lie. They should not have done that. It's crossing the line.
Miles, one of the things that does come out from people in the business community is, well, if SAF Air were to pull out of South Africa, where would we be then? We wouldn't actually be able to, there wouldn't be the capacity to service the market.
At the moment, that is correct. But you can't have convenience above the law. If they aren't complying with the law, that has to be dealt with, and they need to conform. Yes, it would be a shock to the market. The market would take time to recover. But they have a dominant position because they have used tactics that they ought to not have. And the example I use is, you know, if the mafia happened to own all the laundromat, you couldn't leave the mafia untouched because everybody would have dirty clothes. At some point, you have to say, what is right and has to be upheld. So, yes, it would be an enormous shock to the market. They are a very large player. But that's what the requirements are. They have to be followed.
So if I hear you correctly, they've just been breaking the rules and approaching the whole South African airline industry as, well, we'll do it the way we want to. And if we are called up, we'll say sorry.
Well, there's mounting evidence to suggest that's the case. So, certainly they've admitted to overbooking. That's not conjecture. And both councils have found that their ownership structure is improper, yes.
In South Africa, we have got fabulous laws in many areas and they're just not enforced. Is it similar in the airline industry? I'm not talking about the enforcement, but the level of regulations in the South African airline industry, are they world class?
Certainly the safety regulation is world class, and there's a lot of consistency and standards around the globe. In terms of the economic regulation, some people might disagree with it, but there is a rationale for the laws that we have, and you know that they were well considered back when they were promulgated. Whether the enforcement of that, we will now see. So the two licensing councils have this matter before them, and how they approach it will determine how those councils are viewed into the future, whether or not they are seen as effective, or whether or not they give a slap on the wrist. It'll change how that institution is seen, I think. So this is their time to shine, their time to put their foot down and demonstrate how the economic side of the industry will be operated into the future.
And as a participant, how would you react if it was just a slap on the wrist?
Look, if the laws aren't applied, then we would view it as not a viable market, and we would look to downsize in the local market or extract completely. Society is a thing governed by laws, and if the laws don't need to be followed by certain players, then we would extract. There'd be no reason to participate, as I could see.
U.S. banks are currently reporting strong fourth quarter results and share prices are reacting positively. Earlier, I caught up with Corky Koyman from Denker Capital, who talks us through the reasons behind the strong results from the U.S. banking sector. Corky also throws forward to what we can expect from European banks when they start reporting in 2 weeks' time.
Very good results reported last night. A lot of the bank share prices were up, a few of them 6%, Citi, Wells Fargo, Goldman's, Bank of New York, some of the others 3%, 4%. And so the two things that surprised the market, one on the investment banks, was trading and investment-related activity or market-related activity was much stronger than anticipated by the market. And then on the actual banking results, the net interest margins held up a lot better. Now you recall that because of lower interest rates, the market's been concerned the whole time about the pressure on the net interest margins. And they were not as severe as thought. And I think what the market forgets there is these managements take action. I mean, everybody knows interest rates are going to come down. So you start repositioning your balance sheet. And we've been warning investors, you know, that this will happen. And then secondly, to us, which was very positive, is operational expenses were controlled and bad debts remain very low. So U.S. banks, very good results. You can see the market didn't quite expect this result. These were the first three. Bank of America starts reports today, and all the others come in the next 4 or 5 days. But those are the big ones. Valuation.
Before we move off U.S. banks, we need to just touch on the regulatory environment and the loosening of the regulatory environment in the Trump administration when he comes to power.
Yeah, thanks, Bronwyn. I forgot about that because that is key. The banks are fair value, above fair value, not expensive in terms of where they've been and where they could go, but two key elements in the, especially this year and going forward, the one is Trump. And Trump has been strong on a few things. The one is tariffs. I think we all know that at this stage, he was going to slap tariffs on everybody. But the other one is he is adamant that he wants the American economy to grow again, and he's going to reduce a lot of the so-called breaks. A lot of the regulatory burdens that were placed on banks, including holding too much capital, reporting on unnecessary things. So I think where the Democrats and Europe has been very guilty there as well is just, you know, just putting brakes everywhere at trying to prevent something from going wrong. But in doing that, you inhibit growth. You make it very difficult for managements and for corporates to grow. And if it does that, just by reducing the capital that banks have to hold, that increases the return on capital quite a lot. So the market is expecting that, whether that's in the price or not, but that will be quite a positive for US banks in the year going forward.
Then let's move to Europe and European banks. This has been an area that you as Denker Capital have been interested in, have moved on, and it has reflected in your performance to the negative, but good things ahead.
Yeah. So the first 9 months of the year, the European banks re-rated quite a lot. I forget now for the full year whether they did better than the US banks, but on average, even something like Barclays was up, I think now with yesterday's move, 90%. ING, Erste Bank, a lot of those banks in Europe were up 50, 60, so not to be sneezed at. But the last quarter, they took a big club, as I said in Afrikaans, they took a proper down in dollar terms, 20%, simply because of Trump coming in. So the market took a big decision. Trump coming in, Europe is going to lag behind. The euro fell as well. So if we look at the year ahead for European banks, our view is that they remain very mispriced. So in US, you're talking 1.6, 1.7, 1.8 price to NAV. In Europe, you're talking 1.1, 1.2, 1.3. The returns on capital are slightly less, but not much. So, but the market is thinking that Europe is going to be low growth, which we think is true in countries like Germany and France, potentially Italy. But the market is missing countries like Portugal is actually doing quite well. Greece is one of the fastest growing countries in the world now. They got that right again. Even the Netherlands, Poland got a new government. So that's where, you know, we've been looking and adding, and you still get dividend yields of 6-7%.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking, out of the ordinary.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
On the South African political front, Action SA has moved to merge with opposition parties ahead of the local municipal elections in South Africa in 2026. Chris Steyn chatted to Action SA leader Herman Mashaba on the reason for joining forces with Forum for Service Delivery. Mashaba also says they are currently in informal talks with both BOZA and with Rise Mzansi.
Sir, how many municipality or how many municipal seats have you gained with this merger?
This party, Chris, it's represented in five provinces with 38 councillors and 14 municipalities. So overnight, Action SA has got additional 38 councillors represented in 14 municipalities in five provinces. I mean, it's something that honestly, I think on paper would, or if I talk to you right now, it wouldn't make sense. But it is real. And we've allowed these 38 councillors to have a dual membership so that they don't lose their seats. So between now and the elections, as far as IEC is concerned, they will still remain as members of Forum for Service Delivery. But in terms of their work, be in council or in their communities, they're going to be campaigning and working as Action SA the members. So it's exciting. And they are now obviously started, they've already started now getting people who voted them into power to know that they are now officially Action SA councillors as far as the public is concerned. And so it's exciting. And when we prepare for 2026, they officially, you'll see, they're going to contest as Action SA candidates, which is really very exciting. So it's exciting news. And this is the first of many. So this is the beginning. I'm sure you've read in the papers that Action SA it's involved with other parties. Yes, absolutely. I can confirm at the moment only two. We're still at the moment having informal discussions, but we'll see what happens. But we have identified massive opportunities throughout the countries, more especially at local government level, where a lot of community-based organizations registered as political parties, they're sitting with the 5-10 councillors and so forth. So I'm busy negotiating to get as many as possible to do the same kind of an arrangement that we did with Forum for Service Delivery.
Mm. But you can't give us any hints as to which parties you are talking to at the moment.
Well, look, I mean, I don't have to really lie to society. The informal discussions we are having is with Bosa and Rise.
Zanzi?
Zanzi. Yes, those are the two we're having informal discussions. And we've agreed to let us conclude this one first, and then we can then start formal discussions with them.
In the world of technology, Amazon's Alexa has undergone an upgrade through the integration of artificial intelligence. Our partners at the Financial Times have the latest on the story.
Amazon is hoping to transform its Alexa voice assistant system using artificial intelligence. But there are big hurdles in the way, and Amazon is under pressure to make money from consumer AI products. Madhumita Murjia is the FT's artificial intelligence editor, and she joins me now to explain. Hi, Madhu.
Hi there.
So how would you explain what Alexa does now, and how would introducing AI make it different?
Yeah, so this Alexa device, which is, it's a voice-activated assistant, mostly people use it to do things like set a timer or play music on Spotify or connect it to their smart lights to turn all their lights on and off, things like that. But the way it works so far is that you have to ask the question in a specific way and it sort of looks up the answers for you. But what Amazon is trying to do is sort of transplant the brain of that system with a large language model, something like the models that underpin, say, ChatGPT or Google's Gemini, for instance, and make it a lot more colloquial, chatty, as I said, and broader in terms of the types of queries it can respond to. So you can ask it a range of things like sort of sports scores or, you know, where should I go on my holiday to Morocco next month, or make some restaurant reservations, things like that.
Okay, well, what kind of hurdles has Amazon been facing while trying to make this idea into a reality?
Yeah, I mean, I think what they found over the sort of 2 years or two and a bit years that they've worked on it is it's just not as simple as a chatbot that you use online. So what they've really struggled with, I think, is firstly, the technical aspects of integrating a large language model into the current system. There's been the sort of cultural issues around safety. It's in people's homes, used by their children, by old people. So how can we make sure that an Alexa that is being used by a kid is still appropriate? But I think the core issue really is accuracy and, you know, the ability that these generative AI models have to make things up. And when you have an assistant that you're used to giving you answers to questions that you act on, you know, you just can't have them making facts up.
Yeah, that would not be helpful.
Exactly. So they need it to be accurate. They need it to not be unsafe because of the context in which it's being used.
What about money? Is Amazon going to be able to profit off of this new AI Alexa endeavor?
So I think at the moment, all the big tech companies are facing a lot of pressure from the market to kind of show ROI on AI technologies. And so you're seeing that this race dynamic is impacting all tech companies now who feel that they have to show that they're using AI and also making money from it. OpenAI is making money through its subscriptions, of course. So that seems to be the kind of primary business model. But I do think when it comes to Alexa, you know, it hasn't really been a product that's generated a huge amount of money. But I think what they're hoping is that they can charge something like a subscription model or take a cut of sales or build different services into it via these language models and turn it into a sort of new line of business and a new revenue generator.
In that vein, how important is Alexa to Amazon's overall AI strategy?
I think it's a part of it. They have a massive cloud business, which is AWS or Amazon Web Services. And a big part of their AI strategy is allowing their customers to use lots of different AI models through their web services to allow access to that. And they've actually recently released their own models as well, called the Nova models, which are also being, you know, integrated into Alexa. So I think, you know, building a consumer device with generative AI is a really, it's a tough problem. If it does work, it could really be a sort of entirely new type of product. So it's not something that they're going to, you know, be turning huge profits with in the short term.
Madhumi Tamurjia is the FT's artificial intelligence editor. Thanks, Madhu.
Thank you.
Chris Stain spoke to referendum party leader Phil Craig, who has launched a bill to end race-based policy and legislation in South Africa. Craig says support from other parties has been disappointing.
Yeah. So look, so we started to get strong support from the public. I would have liked to have got more support from the established political parties. And in some ways, this bill is going to be a bit of a watershed moment in that, you know, we saw with the Bella bill that effectively the opposition parties or former opposition parties are now form of the government. Part of the government in the GNU have been quite muted. Ultimately, they passed the Bella bill when they could have used the consensus clause to block it. And I think that was a mistake. Many of those parties are, you know, strongly opposed, or at least theoretically, to non-racialism. And we hope now that those parties are going to stand up and support this bill when it comes to Parliament and say, well, we believe in non-racialism too, and we reject the ANC's obsession with race-based policy. We've now got more race laws now than we did under apartheid, and they'll help us bring this to an end. And if they do, great, that would be our first choice. And if they don't, then at least voters then can see how the parties that they voted for are performing and then start to reevaluate whether those parties are the best vehicle for them going forward if ultimately they're not going to make a stand on the issues that are important to the voters who voted for them.
And have you had any personal interaction with people in those parties on the bill? People who are on a position?
Look, so unfortunately, at this point in time, probably the two main opposition parties that we would be aligned with would be the DA and the Freedom Front Plus. We've written to all political parties and major civic organisations. In general, civic organisations came back to us and said, "Look, we support the bill. Great, please go ahead." And the political parties have largely ignored us, and I think that's been frustrating. So we have specifically invited parties to comment. We provided them with a copy of the bill. We provided them to give input into the bill, and ultimately they've opted not to do so. And look, without naming names at this point, with one of the parties, with the DA, the first person or one person indicated that they would help us with the bill, and then suddenly were unable to help us there. After and obviously there's a strong suspicion there that the party politics is now coming into play, which is frustrating because, I mean, the referendum party, we're a tiny party, we don't have representation in government, we're trying to do the right thing, and ultimately this has to rise above party politics, and we have to serve the best interests of the voters.
and we've got this huge ideological minority population in South Africa who are up against it, you know, with the ANC, MK, and the EFF. And we need the sort of, let me call them the sort of the centre-right parties to stand up and to have courage. And there's no point in being inside the GNU if you're then not going to stand up for the issues that people voted you to put you there. So yeah, very disappointing so far. But when the bill comes before committee, then obviously the parties in the G will have to then publicly show their hand, and then we'll see where they stand. And I suspect that once they publicly have to take a stand, it'd be very difficult for those parties to oppose this bill.
Taking a quick look at the markets as we move into the close today, Richemont was the star performer, up almost 16% on the day, given stronger than expected results for the 3 months to the end of December. Analysts are saying that this may in fact indicate a broader industry trend turning to a recovery in the luxury goods market. PPC news out from that company, although the stock closed down today more than 3%, is to construct a 3 billion cement plant in the Western Cape, that in partnership with Sinoma Overseas. The project is expected to take 2 years to completion, and PPC says that it will be funded by its debt facilities. On the downside, we have the platinum stocks lower, and on the upside today, as I said, Richemont, the strong performer on the South African Stock Exchange, with those stronger than expected results out today. Thank you for joining us for this BizNews briefing. We'll be back on Monday, the 20th of January, to bring you more of the same, both locally and internationally.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.